Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Well, there, that felt good. Today is January 23rd. It's 3 days after the inauguration, and already the assault on science, objective reality, and facts has begun. And I just felt like it would be appropriate to kind of get back to some of my early teenage interests in punk rock. There you go. Not the usual kind of intro music, but I hope you liked it as a bit of a change. Today, I'm talking, as I usually do, to a scientist who actually has an interest in facts, the pursuit of facts, understanding facts, and interpreting them. It's Nerli Abram from the Australian National University, ANU, in Canberra, Australia. I caught Nerli just before she headed out on a big trip with her family. Part of our talk actually is about family and the importance of having reasonable family leave policies as she experienced in Australia and later on in her career in the UK. The US is already probably the bottom of the world in that category, and we can hope that it at least doesn't get any worse in the coming years. We'll see. But the talk really is today mostly about science, and some of the interesting things that I hope you'll pick up on is sort of the excitement and the possibilities that can come about if you radically change both the location and the specifics of your work, in this case, narrowly moving from work on corals and Indian Ocean kind of topics to working at the British Antarctic Survey with ice cores, a topic she had never worked with before. So don't be afraid to try something incredibly new. And then moving on into Nerli's interest in the Pages 2K suite of activities and trying to understand how to bring together these big, diverse sets of paleoclimate proxies that can be pretty challenging to deal with. Overall, I hope if you're coming to this for the first time, especially, you know, right now with the discussion about what facts actually are, I think a lot of the discussion in this interview really centers around how people are trying to understand these kinds of data, which inevitably do have lots of uncertainty in them, from the corals to the ice cores, and doing the best they really can to bring together multiple lines of evidence, both statistically and in terms of the data, to address some of the really big questions that we have in front of us, such as when did the era of modern warming actually begin? And Nerli and a huge bunch of colleagues had a paper on that in Nature 2016. And Nerli and I talked about the origins of that paper and also one of her other papers in Science and the really, really long ramp up that's involved in doing that kind of work, both in terms of the scope, the detective work that's involved. And for the Nature paper, the review process itself was, you know, honestly, it was fairly grueling. And I asked Nerli if it was okay to talk about it, and she said, fine. So for young scientists out there who were thinking about submitting to Nature or Science journals like this, it's a bit of a glimpse into what you might expect during that kind of a review process. Otherwise, I'm heading off in just about 2 weeks to a meeting in New Zealand that I think I've mentioned before. It's called the International Symposium on the Cryosphere in a Changing Climate. And about 1/3 of what we publish in Nature in physical climate has to do with the cryosphere or with sea level rise, the two, of course, being intimately linked. So it's a huge area of interest for me. We publish a lot of papers on that. Really looking forward to that. And if you're down there, by all means, get a hold of me via Twitter in advance. Happy to set up meetings or just through email. I'm happy to meet up with you down there if you'd like to talk about Nature, publishing, or anything else. And now here we go. On to my interview with Nerli Abram. We began talking about the time off that Nerli and her husband have when the kids are off with the grandparents. You're childless right now. Your kids are, did he say, off with your parents for a couple of weeks of a break? Is that right?
Yeah, we're going up there tomorrow, so we'll go and collect them and go camping for a week, which will be lovely.
What do you do for 2 weeks when you don't have your three kids?
I talk to my husband. It's amazing.
How old are they?
They're 13, 11, and 8. They're good. They have a lovely time up there in the summer, even though sometimes they sort of whinge about they want to come home, but then they realize that actually at home they'd just be sitting around while we're trying to work. So it's much more fun at the grandparents' place.
The grandparents I think I'm going to mispronounce this, but I'm pretty sure about that. But there, are they in Wangi?
Yeah, Wangi.
I was kind of remotely close. And this is on the shores of Lake Macquarie, right?
Macquarie.
Right, I'm completely mangling all the Australian pronunciation. I'm sorry.
That's all right. We probably mangle them from what they're meant to be. But anyway.
And that's where you grew up. You were there for your entire childhood and until you went to university. What was it like? I guess it's kind of a bit of a resort community away from Sydney by just an hour and a half or so.
Yeah, well, when I was growing up there, it was a small town. It was quite isolated. There's a lot of suburbs all the way sort of around the lake, and then there's a big city to the north called Newcastle. But yeah, growing up there, it was lovely. There's a lot of bush around right on the lake, so a lot of time spent just exploring sort of out the back gate and up into the bushland, or down exploring the rocky sort of foreshore. And then lots of sort of trips away camping with the family. Yeah, it was a good place to grow up.
From the Australian perspective, does the word bush just mean anything that is not a city?
Yeah. Just the natural surroundings is the bush.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got a younger sister. She's 3 years younger than me, but born on exactly the same day. So we grew up having shared birthdays, which was lovely too.
Then you grew up almost as a, well, I wouldn't say like a feral child, but you had a lot of freedom, it sounds like, in terms of just getting outside on your own and getting into trouble outdoors. Did you have any sort of major misadventures during that time?
I can't recall any major misadventures. I think I was always a bit of a worrier of a child of like what could go wrong. So I didn't get up to too much mischief. But I just remember that being sort of a very relaxed way of growing up, and it's something that we try and get our kids sort of outdoors and away from sort of all these sort of screens, and really taking in that sort of how lucky we are to have such beautiful nature around us.
We took our son camping in Yosemite last summer, and he was really upset because he wasn't allowed to go hiking up Half Dome. you're only five, and it's a 16-mile hike round trip. You need to do a little bit of training before you can do that. Well, yeah, we're going to get him there. I feel the same way. We live in the Bay Area, but it's surrounded by this amazing country. But it's just a bit of an effort to get out. I suppose in Canberra, it's not a huge city, so getting out to the quasi mountains around there isn't too bad.
Canberra's known as the bush capital. So even though it's the capital of Australia, it's fairly small, and it was a planned city as well, a bit like Washington, D.C., but it means that it's all very nice and structured. There's lots of green space, and then it's a two-hour drive to the coast or a two-hour drive to the ski fields in winter, and it's a beautiful country to explore.
Your mother was a teacher, and your father had education background in geomorphology, but it sounds like he then spent most of his professional career working in ammonia producing factory.
Yeah.
Did that mean that you had a lot of exposure to interest in pedagogical research and science, or did they keep that kind of separate from the family life?
Dad did his degree while I was in primary school, so that was nice to actually sort of see that studying and learning little bits and pieces, so that when we'd go camping, he'd be pointing out features in the landscape, and we, as kids, did a few sort of long trips where we sort of went off for 3 months and travelled around Australia a few times, doing that with my dad, who was really sort of fascinated by the landscape. I think a lot of that rubbed off, and that's probably where a lot of my sort of love of nature came from. He didn't ever sort of work in geomorphology. It was while he was studying that he got the job at the chemical plant, and then that was a shift work job, and it was a pay the bills kind of job. There was a lot of the sort of the recreational time, though. I think we got a lot of advantage out of his study.
Did he just have a dream of getting a degree in geomorphology? I mean, I've had friends who've gotten degrees, PhDs in forestry, for example, but never had any intention of actually being a forester, and they just wanted the degree. What was it like for your father?
Originally, he worked in a cement factory, and the cement factory closed down. He was made redundant, and so the degree was his sort of retraining. And then in the meantime, while he was getting the degree, that's when he got this new job at the chemical factory. I think when he was doing the degree, there was some sort of thoughts of, yes, this could sort of lead to a job in some sort of remote places. And he did look at a few opportunities there, but I think it was a bit too much of a call to move the family sort of out into the remote Australian desert.
Yes, I can imagine. I talked to Laura Wilcox a little while ago, and even though she grew up in England, industrialized, heavily scientific country, she said that until she was fairly advanced in her studies, she never really was exposed to scientists and just didn't have an idea that being a scientist was even a career option. With your parents and what they were doing, did you have a sense at a younger age that becoming a scientist really might be something possible as a career?
I was always very much encouraged that I could do anything that I wanted to do. I think my career choice was basically just guided by sort of what I was interested in. I toyed with sort of engineering or science or even becoming a national park ranger. Yeah, all those kinds of things. But yeah, settled for the science.
You got your bachelor's degree in 2000 from the University of Sydney. Did you think about going any farther afield at that point or internationally, or did you want to stay kind of close to home at that point?
I certainly didn't contemplate international. At that stage, I'd never been overseas. And so this whole idea that I might have even, that could have been a possibility to study overseas was definitely not on my radar. And I guess that the traditional path would have been to, for a lot of the people who live in that sort of Lake Macquarie, Newcastle area, you go to the local university. So for me to go to University of Sydney was even though it's only sort of an hour and a half down the road, it was actually quite a big call to not go to the local university. And partly that was driven by my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, was working in Sydney. So I had options for where I wanted to go. And in the end, I think that probably played a big role in my decision to move to Sydney. Absolutely.
When you were applying to university at the time, what was it like in Australia in terms of the competitiveness of the application process?
To get into the undergrad programs, it very much depended on which university you wanted to go to. And I had a lot of options. So my marks coming out of high school were good. And I guess apart from sort of the love aspect, the other reason for choosing Sydney was that they were just starting up the Bachelor of Science advanced degree. And so that actually required you to use those sort of extra marks that you had. That I didn't want to go into medicine, or I didn't want to go into law, those things that you could have done with having sort of good high school marks. Right. But I also wanted to feel like I was doing something with them. And so feeling like I was going into sort of a top-notch program. And it turned out to be, a really good decision, I think, because that new advanced science, it was a science degree, but in all of the courses there were extra classes and you were with a smaller cohort who were doing sort of advanced studies on top of all of that. So I think that was a really stimulating and sort of research learning environment to be in.
What does it mean to have an advanced designation in Australia?
It means that you've done something extra in terms of your degree. So for my degree, there were a certain number of my courses that I had to study at an advanced level, which meant that I took the regular chemistry course, but at lunchtimes I also did extra courses with a lecturer and just a small number of students where we would do extended learning and there would be extra assessments for that, and that would give you credits in chemistry advanced, and they had those for physics and math. When it came to earth sciences, we had to actually sort of make something up because I don't think anybody anticipated needing an advanced earth sciences. We managed to sort of make that work.
What did you end up adding on for the advanced earth sciences?
That ended up being in my third year, needing an extra advanced course, and I wasn't sort of taking enough of the physics and chemistry anymore to be able to get my advanced courses. We sort of sat down with the people designing the degrees and said, well, what can we do in earth sciences? And I had a lecturer who was mentoring me, and basically he would give me papers to read and then I would write essays on those and then we would follow that. And just getting into those early sort of research skills.
Good training for writing reviews down the road, I suppose. Sounds like.
Definitely. I didn't realize it at the time, but yes.
And your PhD, which you got in 2004, from the Australian National University, you were working, at least in part, on coral death and its interactions with the Indian Ocean Dipole and fires. Can you talk about how you got initially involved in your work with corals and what was driving the interest in that particular paper, which came out, I believe, in Science?
It did, That was quite a highlight of the grad program.
Yeah, no kidding.
Science paper. And really, it was a byproduct of the main research project. So we went out to these islands off the coast of Sumatra back in 1997. We had the huge El Nino event, but over in the Indian Ocean was doing weird things and had this really cool pool of water off the coast of Sumatra and warmer water over near Africa, and that really sort of played havoc with the rainfall patterns in the region. And it was based on that event that then in 1999 people came up with the idea that actually maybe the Indian Ocean wasn't just following what was happening in the Pacific Ocean with El Nino, and that there was this independent climate phenomenon going on called the Indian Ocean Dipole. So I started my PhD program in 2000, and so that was a really good time to jump on and say, okay, let's go collect corals from this area that looks like it's a real focus area. It's where, when we have one of these sort of strong positive Indian Ocean dipole events, we get very cold water, and we should be able to see that in the corals.
Right.
We went out there. But when we went out there, this entire stretch of coral reef, 400 kilometres long of coral reef on the Mentawai Islands, it's about 200 kilometres offshore of Sumatra, everything was dead. Then it was not just the coral that had died, but also all the fish. It was just the area just being completely devastated. And the unusual thing there was 1998, sort of off the back of that El Nino, was one of the first real sort of global coral bleaching events. So coral death wasn't unusual, but the water where these corals were was cool. So they hadn't died because of heat from bleaching.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up kind of with this whodunit of what was going on. How can we explain this reef death? And we talked to local villagers, and one of the things that they were describing was that before the reef died, the whole surface of the water turned this reddish colour, and then the coral died and all the fish died. And so that pointed us in the direction of some sort of algae bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And so for an algae bloom, you need nutrients. And this cold water that was coming up because of the ocean patterns would have been nutrient rich. So that was sort of one of the ideas. Well, maybe it's just something that can happen because you get this nutrient rich water upwelling during an Indian Ocean dipole event.
Right.
But what we were able to do was to go back through lots of our fossil coral records and see that in the past there had been these types of upwelling events of an equivalent or even sort of much greater magnitude going on, and the corals had sailed right through it, recorded all the chemistry in their skeleton and just kept on growing as if that wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we sort of thought, well, okay, if we can't explain it just by the ocean patterns, then what else was going on? And at the same time, during this big El Nino event and the Indian Ocean Dipole event, Indonesia was incredibly dry. And that combined with the slash and burn agricultural practices that were going on meant that there were these huge wildfires. And then when we took a look at the satellite images, we could see that the smoke plume from these wildfires in 1997 extended right out over the top of where we'd seen this massive reef death. And so that was where we sort of came to the conclusion that we can't explain this just by the oceans alone, but we have this nutrient source from the wildfires. So this extra stressor that really kicked these reefs.
It is, as you say, amazing detective story that brought that paper all together. How did you come to have that level of inquiry in graduate school? Was it through interaction with your advisor, or do you feel that you just have this innate sense or ability to look for these kinds of mechanistic explanations when you see phenomena like mass coral die-off?
Certainly, my grad advisor was amazing, taught me a huge amount about how to do research, how to write these types of high-impact papers,
mm-hmm.
all these sort of skills that are really important. So I think, yeah, there was certainly that prompting. But yeah, there was a lot of digging down and trying to think what makes sense, and then can I find information about this, and finding sort of that, yes, somebody had measured the composition of the ash that was coming off these smoke plumes, and yes, there was satellite information that could show us where they went, and searching and searching and gradually finding the bits of information to put it all together. It was a fun project, really fun.
Do you think that having, I don't know if patience is the right word, or diligence or a sense of inquiry can be taught for a successful long-term career in science? Or do you think that on a personality level, you need to have that innately if you're going to be able to first pose and then do the hard work that's necessary to track down these kind of questions?
There's certainly some of the skills can be taught, and I'm not sure if it's all just diligence. Sometimes it might be obsessiveness.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And when there's questions, just not being able to switch off from those until you're sort of satisfied that you've got some sort of answer that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that probably comes down to more of a personality. And I think science, for all sorts of reasons, requires people who are going to be able to stick it out in this game to have that kind of determination. So not just the skills in science, but being able to really stick with a problem, even when all of the circumstances around might be making it difficult to do that, and particularly in terms of now when you look at the job market in science. Yeah. And for postdocs coming through, it's a very different world that they have to try and find their way through.
I often think that finishing a PhD doesn't necessarily require the most brilliant mind, but you definitely have to be incredibly stubborn.
Definitely.
When I look at your overall career, I mean, you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, but it kind of seems like there were maybe three, so far, phases to your research. In your early work, you were publishing on things like the corals, but in particular about Indian Ocean dipole and Indian Ocean variability. So sort of think about broad-scale atmosphere-ocean interactions that are at least partially tied towards the modern era. And then in 2004 to 2011, you moved to the British Antarctic Survey, where some of this tropical work was published. But during that, you had a lot of publications that were looking at, for example, sea ice proxies, and in particular, yeah, the evaluation of methane sulfonic acid as a sea ice proxy. And then more recently, you've been involved in things like the PAGES 2K programs that are looking at major hemispheric reconstructions over the past 2,000 years. Going, first of all, if I'm right about this, like kind of going from the Indian Ocean work towards the ice core work, and also your move towards England and the British Antarctic Survey, what was driving both the move itself and then the shift in interest?
By the time I'd completed my PhD, I had realized that there was a wider world out there and there were opportunities to do things outside of Australia. I'd traveled overseas at that stage. So one of the things that I'm lucky to enjoy is that I have a British passport as well as an Australian passport. So my dad was born in Dover. We had this idea, myself and my husband, that after my PhD, that we would like to go and experience living in Europe. And Britain was a natural choice because we had the language. So it was actually, it came about as a discussion with Nick Shackleton when he was visiting ANU. He was coming to talk with John Chappell, who was one of my advisors, and I was sort of starting to put the feelers out for postdocs. And so I was lucky enough to be able to sit down and just have a casual chat with Nick Shackleton and say, look, I'm interested in opportunities that might be in the UK. Have you got any ideas of who I should contact? Right. And he'd suggested, well, why don't you contact Eric Wolfe at the British Antarctic Survey, which I did. And he said, yeah, we've got a position that's opening up. Why don't you apply for it? Lo and behold, they took on somebody who had no previous experience with ice cores.
I was wondering about that because it seems like a real departure.
I know everybody says that, but I think apart from, yes, the instruments that you use in the lab are different and you have to work in a freezer, but apart from that, the actual what you're doing with those time series is the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Those scientific skills are still, you can apply them in exactly the same way. We decided that we would move to the UK. We told our family that we were going for 2 years. Partly at this stage, I had a 9-month-old who was the first grandchild on both sides of the family.
Wow.
So the grandparents were a little bit horrified by this announcement that we were taking their grandchild to the other side of the world. But anyway, so we said, yeah, we'll go for 2 years. And then, yeah, 7 years later, we sort of eventually decided it was time to move back sort of closer to home again. But I think as well, one thing that I didn't realise at the time that I was just so lucky was at that time, the British Antarctic Survey, when they took on postdocs, mm-hmm. they took them on open-ended contracts. Oh. So this idea that you could step from a PhD straight into like a permanent research position at an organization like the British Antarctic Survey. I certainly fell on my feet and had no idea at the time how lucky I was because of that.
Is that system still in place or has it gone by the wayside?
No, they have gone back to the short-term contracts, which is partly to do with the change in how they get their funding and that their funding is now linked to these shorter-term mm-hmm. sort of research grants rather than being a block of money that they then decide these are our research priorities and let's do this. So, yeah, a sign of the times.
When we moved to London in 2008, I came with a job in Nature. my wife had an incredibly hard time finding a job there. I think partially because it seems like in the UK, you have to get into a career track at a very young age. And if you're trying to get into something in your late 30s, it's really difficult. What did your husband have something lined up, or did he spend some time raising the kids? What did he do when you arrived?
He spent some time getting us set up and daddy daycare, which I think both he and our daughter absolutely loved. When he decided that it was time to start working again, he did find that it was quite difficult. So he works in human resources, mm-hmm. which is a very transferable kind of job. But a lot of the recruiting agencies, wouldn't acknowledge any of his Australian skills because he didn't have the British
certifications
human resources
or whatever it might be.
Yeah, he did have troubles, and actually it wasn't until he approached an employer directly about a job ad rather than going through a recruiting agency that then he was able to actually meet them and got a job and, working in Cambridge as well. So it all worked out. But it was surprising that there was that barrier there. We weren't expecting that.
I noticed on your CV you have the listings of your three maternity leaves. And I've seen this on the CVs of a few other female scientists, including Dr. Dahl Jensen. And I'm curious, is this standard practice in Australia? Do you do it because you feel that this should be done when preparing your CV? Or what are your motivations for including that information?
I include it because I think it's really important that we're highlighting what are my achievements relative to the opportunities, and that we really need to, both for men and women, be taking into account that people have career breaks for all sorts of reasons.
Right.
Obviously, for women, maternity leave is a really big one, and particularly the timing ends up being a lot of the time when you're trying to go between sort of short-term contracts. And so it's really important that we get into sort of the minds of people who are evaluating these CVs, that they do need to take this into account, and that somebody who has 5 years of experience or 5 years out of their PhD but hasn't had any career interruptions shouldn't be evaluated in the same way as somebody who is 5 years out of their PhD but has had a child or two.
Right.
You really need to take that into account. It is something that certainly in the Australian system, when we apply for grants here, we do complain that and whinge to our colleagues about everything that we have to do in terms of the CVs that we produce for those. Mm-hmm. It's not just a two-page CV. It's all sorts of detailed information. But I think that the motivation behind that is good, and it's all about trying to really sort of tease out where are people at relative to the time that they've spent in research, and making sure that we're really taking into account these career breaks properly. But I think in terms of, even without sort of spelling it out in sort of big letters, I think just an acknowledgement that I've had three children and this is equivalent to 2.5 full-time years, mm-hmm. just making that sort of statement so that people can just make people think that, yes, we do need to take that into account.
When you were taking your maternity leaves, did you go offline completely, or did you have colleagues or students that you had to keep active, so still had to come into the office or deal with work emails occasionally?
Mostly I was able to go offline. I mean, with my first daughter, I was still writing my PhD, so that obviously I didn't really have much downtime there. The PhD was meant to come before the child, but they had different ideas. But anyway, my next two, when I was based at the British Antarctic Survey, certainly I was in that permanent position. The organisation and the country had fabulous maternity leave allowances, so I really was free to walk out the door just before I had the baby, and then sort of really there was no obligation for me to make any contact or to come back until I was ready to actually come back and properly be working. That said, I did keep contact and I did do some of those other things. So mm-hmm. like you noticed that I did publish coral papers while I was at the British Antarctic
yes.
Survey. A lot of those were things that I spent time on when I was on maternity leave. Coral work wasn't sort of part of my paid work at the British Antarctic Survey, so that's where I was tidying up those things that were sort of hanging over from my PhD that needed to be published.
In the US, we have probably the most appallingly bad maternity or paternity leave system in the industrialized world. When you talk to female or male colleagues in America, I mean, sort of think about the various career paths and how people's promotion and tenure and leaves are going, what do you think are or are there any advantages to the U.S. system, which is severely penalizing of long-term leaves and often without the ability to consider things like taking time off?
Yeah, I don't think that there's any benefit to the workers or to the families in that situation. I think it only really benefits the economy and the organizations.
Yeah. If that, actually.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. If you treat your employees properly and you give them the time that they need, then they're going to be more productive in the long run rather than trying to juggle working at a time when really that's not what they need to be doing. I don't know if I would still be in science if I had come through in that system.
Well, let's turn to the work that you were getting paid to do at the British Antarctic Conservancy. Maybe this, yep. the sea ice proxy work. Can you talk about what the motivating factors were to have an interest in reconstructing sea ice variations and some of the difficulties that you ran into in terms of separating out the atmospheric transport versus the direct sea ice signal in methane sulfonic acid?
Yeah, sea ice is a difficult thing.
It hasn't gotten any easier, has it?
I'd like to hope that we've made some progress, but I mean, it's such an important part of the climate system, and we know that we don't get it right in climate models. Mm-hmm. We really, really need to be able to understand what the natural behavior of sea ice is, but at the same time, it's a really difficult thing because it grows and it decays. There's nothing sort of permanent to actually be recording within the sea ice what the sea ice is doing. So you need to be looking at things that are a bit more indirect than, say, if we take an ice core and we want to use that to look at the temperature information that we get from the snowfall. It's a lot more direct than if we're trying to say we're going to take that ice core and we're going to look at the chemistry in there, and that's going to tell us about how much sea ice there was somewhere offshore of where that ice core is. So there's a lot of...
It sounds quite daunting, right?
It is daunting. There's a lot of steps there. So you've got the sea ice, the proxy relies on having biological productivity that's occurring related to that sea ice, and particularly when that sea ice decays from its winter maximum down through the summer, then you get these blooms of algae that produce dimethyl sulfide. Mm-hmm. That goes into the atmosphere. It's oxidized and you get methane sulfonic acid. And then some of that methane sulfonic acid gets transported over Antarctica, where it can then be deposited and trapped in an ice core. There's a lot of steps. So again, this is something I came into. There'd been a science paper in 2003 using the Laudome ice core, which looked like there was a beautiful sea ice relationship in the Laudome ice core, and showing that even though over Antarctica in the satellite era we were seeing what looked to be like an increasing trend in sea ice, which mm-hmm. was a bit of a puzzle. From the Laudome ice core, it looked like if you stepped back and had a bigger picture, then you would see that from the 1950s, there'd actually been a long-term decline in sea ice, but also that there were these very strong decadal cycles. So our satellite records are just too short to really be trying to interpret any trends that might be going on, because they're just so short relative to the variability.
So you're just seeing a little wiggle at the long end of a much larger whip being lashed around.
Yeah, and so trying to decide, have you got an increasing trend or a decreasing trend, is really very much determined by where you are on that decadal cycle. Mm-hmm. So that was the motivation again. So it was, okay, this proxy looks like it's got some legs. Let's see what happens if we go and have a look at some of the other ice cores from around Antarctica.
Right.
And I started working on ice cores from the Weddell Sea. And in the Weddell Sea, I got completely the opposite answer to what was seen at Laudome. So it was instantly a, what's going on?
But I mean, there are areas of Antarctica that do have an anti-phase behavior, in particular on the west and the east of the Antarctic Peninsula. Was something like that going on in this case, or no?
No, it was more the relationship of the MSA to sea ice. So mm-hmm. at Laudome, when you had more sea ice, then you would end up with more MSA delivered to your ice core. Whereas in the Weddell Sea, when we had more sea ice, we had less MSA delivered to our ice core.
Because of the differences in local circulation, atmospheric circulation.
Yeah, so that was the conclusion that we came to, was that at Laudome you've got a fairly simple situation where you've got your sea ice is very close to the coast. Laudome is a long way north compared to most places in Antarctica, and so you have the MSA being produced, and then you don't have to transport it very far before you get it to be able to deposit it at Law Dome. So you are able to see this production signal. Whereas at the Weddell Sea, we've got expansive sea ice, and we've got a geography that very much sort of focuses the winds to flow. If you have winds that are blowing offshore, so taking cold air from Antarctica off the continent, making the sea ice more expansive, and potentially that's producing more MSA, but your winds are blowing that MSA away from your ice core sites. So you produce the MSA, but you can't actually record it in your ice core. And then if you've got less sea ice, you tend to have warmer winds that are blowing onshore, so that's favourable for getting the MSA into the ice core. So the take-home message from all of that was that this isn't a universal proxy. It's one that we really have to do some very careful assessments of our sites so that we know what's controlling the signal at individual sites around Antarctica.
So if you wanted to try and do this going back in time, you could first of all understand the modern day patterns of circulation that are either delivering or not delivering the MSA to the ice cores, but then you couldn't very likely just assume that those circulation patterns are stationary going back in time. So then you'd have to bring in some other kind of reconstruction of something like the southern annular mode, which you've also worked on to try and constrain maybe how those could have changed in the past. And then you have a lot of unknowns coming into this reconstruction with that kind of a very complicated question where you don't have a direct recorder that is being influenced strongly by other patterns. Do you see a clear path forward either through MSA or through some of the other proxies to reconstruct robustly sea ice over let's say like the Pages 2K time horizon?
I think that there are ways forward, and it's not just MSA that we have as a proxy. There's also, it seems like over some longer timescales, that the sea salts become a good proxy for sea ice, the non-sea salt sodium in particular. And the idea there is that you, on top of sea ice, so sea ice regularly gets flooded by the ocean coming over the top of it. Mm-hmm. And so its surface is very salty. So you have this very salty snow on top of it that can be, when you get a strong wind event, can be lifted up and is very enriched in sodium. And so there is an idea, it's not accepted by everybody, that the long-term, more the glacial to interglacial changes that we see in the ice cores in terms of the sea salt sodium could actually be telling us about how much sea ice there was around Antarctica. But I think for all of these proxies, the key is that they are complicated, and so we need to understand the site well, but we need to also be evaluating them alongside other lines of evidence. So be that information that we can get from marine sediment cores about potential shifts in the ice edge, or the information that we can get from the ice cores about what's going on in terms of atmospheric circulation. So again, looking at all of the bits of evidence that we have and what interpretations do we feel confident in making based on that, and just being aware that, yeah, when you're dealing with indirect proxies, things can change that you're not expecting.
I suppose this idea of trying to bring together multiple lines of evidence to tackle one problem is a growing feature of a lot of the paleoclimate reconstruction work. In particular, I'm thinking about your work with the Pages 2K program, which does bring together a lot of different proxies. How did that program arise in the community? Why did you want to study the past 2,000 years? Was it just because, I mean, this is when you have the most data available? Or was it viewed as being a really compelling scientific question?
I think that it came about, and I wasn't involved in the very earliest parts of sort of the 2K project, but I think that one of the things that was emphasized in one of the IPCC reports, probably AR4, I think, was that we had these records like the hockey stick that was famous and controversial, but we really needed to know more than just what was going on with global temperature. And so trying to get this information and break it down to start looking at regional signals and getting more coverage in the southern hemisphere, which didn't really have a good reconstruction at all. So it was the idea that, yeah, this is an important period of time for being able to put in context the recent warming that we're seeing. But there's other benefits as well in the climate forcings, the natural climate forcings. There's some knowledge of what was going on with them. And at the same time, we've had the advances in supercomputing power. So Whereas a few years ago, climate modelers would have just rolled their eyes if you asked them to, can I do a 1,000 year simulation? now it's kind of a routine thing. And so all those things, I think, point to sort of this area being a really rich time period that we can learn a lot about Earth's climate and the natural variability, as well as the human impacts in the more recent period, by really sort of focusing attention. There is a lot of data that we can draw on for that.
When you and your colleagues are trying to bring together multiple lines of evidence, so you have this interesting cocktail over the past 2,000 years of things like tree rings, you might be looking at varved lake sediments, ice cores, coral records, there's a whole suite of potential paleoclimate archives. They all have their strengths and weaknesses, the degree to which they record local variability, their among sample variability at any one location, their ability to pick up secular trends or to have systematic biases introduced into data. when you get that community together, what's the community dynamic like in those discussions when you bring together people from these really different fields who are specialists in their fields, maybe not in others, and you're trying to figure out a way to reconstruct regional variability over the past 2,000 years?
Yeah, my experiences with the 2K project is that it's incredibly collaborative and everybody is wanting to work together. And I think that's the benefit of having something that's been a big community project, is that we're able to make sure that we are capturing the people who are experts in all of those different records. You can't sort of as one scientist know all of those ins and outs of all of those different records and regions, and so it really draws on all of that expert knowledge and valuing that knowledge that everybody can bring if you're sort of working together as a large team. And I've found that very rewarding, and I've learned a lot from that process, and I've got a huge number of collaborators now who I probably never would have had a chance to work with without having this 2K project that we were able to sort of focus on and do some really big science together and really drawing on that expertise. So I think that, there haven't been sort of issues that I've seen of people saying my proxy is better than yours. It's really sort of, making sure that we're capturing the information and that we know sort of what are the strengths of different proxies, what's the best way of using them, what do we have to be careful of, and making sure that you're really keeping those experts involved.
So people didn't have their favorite proxy that they were arguing for. I mean, I know you're well aware of this famous graph. I'm not even sure who initially proposed it, but the idea that you have a new proxy with a very high level of enthusiasm, then you begin to find out all these problems like you did with the MSA sea ice reconstructions. Yep. And then it kind of recovers to some level of cautious optimism / skepticism about the proxy. When you're doing things like Pages 2K, you're dealing with proxies that are going to be at different places on this curve. So I'm curious about the statistical approach to dealing with these data. And in particular, does the community now adopt a Bayesian approach where you're introducing priors on the uncertainties, or are there still strong frequentist arguments about treating them all equally? How is that now being done with your reconstructions?
I think that we're still exploring all of those options. So, for example, the Ocean 2K project, they produced a 2,000-year reconstruction where it was just a standardized, simple composite in sort of 200-year bins, but still yielded much more information than we've ever had before for sort of understanding the trends in the global ocean. So that was a very simple approach and driven by the fact that when you're in the oceans dealing with marine sediment cores, you've got issues of much larger age uncertainties. We don't know how to calibrate the records.
Yeah.
And all those sorts of things. So again, it's taking what you know about those records and what you think the limitations are on how you can interpret those records and making sure that you're using the right methods for that. But I think that the community is doing a lot of work in trying to refine the methods and develop new methods and really sort of understanding what are the effects on our reconstructions of different assumptions.
In the summer of 2016, you and a long list of your Pages 2K collaborators published a paper in Nature looking at the emergence of a warming signal well before it had previously been suspected, going back to the early 19th century. How did that particular research question come about from the group? Was it a goal to detect the timing of this, or did it somehow emerge from the data in the analysis process?
Before I say that, it was summer in your hemisphere. It was winter down here when that paper was published. But anyway, that aside. So the project came out of the work that I was doing with the Ocean 2K group. And previously, I'd published some work just based on the James Ross Island ice core. One of the things that we were seeing there was evidence for strong warming on the Antarctic Peninsula during the 20th century, which was different to sort of the Antarctica 2K view of the whole of Antarctica, and also that we had this strong sort of melt signal. And it was through that process that I'd looked at sort of what can we do in terms of change point detection. And so then sort of taking that method, and that was one of the things that I was able to sort of, as part of this Ocean 2K group, one of the things that I threw into the mix was, well, I've got this technique, how about we apply it to the coral reconstructions that we've produced for the tropical oceans, and look at, well, when did the recent warming trend begin? And that's where we kind of first had this sort of answer showing us that the tropical oceans looked like they were beginning to warm in around about the 1830s, and we thought, well, that's kind of interesting, and that's earlier than we would have kind of naturally thought.
Yeah.
So then it was, okay, well, let's try and understand this partly in terms of for Ocean 2K, partway through the process, just for logistics, we'd broken into sort of a high-resolution group that were working on the coral records and a low-resolution group that were working on the marine sediment records. And we'd published our individual papers, but we wanted to come together and do something that was sort of all of Ocean 2K group working together. Mm-hmm. So really looking at the 2000-year low-resolution reconstruction, had found that there was a long-term cooling. We'd found that in the tropical oceans, in the high-resolution group, we saw this recent warming. So it was, okay, when did the oceans sort of have this transition, and how did that relate to what was going on land? And so from that point then, once we realised, well, we really need to evaluate this alongside all of the terrestrial information, so that's when it became a full Pages 2K consortium people, and we reached out to the people who'd been involved in those regional continent scale reconstructions to bring more people onto the team, and worked on that and produced something that, yeah, I'm really sort of proud of sort of what we were able to do as a group on that.
It was an interesting review process on that paper. I mean, that might not be the word that you'd use for it, but I guess maybe we can have a quick chat about this, because I think that a lot of people don't know how the review process tends to go or can go at Nature or really any journal. But how did you initially decide where to submit it? Science or Nature probably would have been the two candidates.
It actually started at AGU in 2014, I think it was. We had a paper on the early version of this work. And at that stage, I thought, maybe this has got a shot in Nature Climate Change. Mm-hmm. And on the flight across to the US, Bronwyn Wake happened to be on the plane. And I said, I've got this poster. Do you want to come and have a look at it and let me know what you think? So she came along to the poster. Yeah, and she said, yeah, keep on developing this, and this looks really interesting. And so we kept on working on it. And as we kept on working on it, and we kept on really testing the ideas and testing the statistics and thinking, this is a really important story, and it seems to be really robust. And that was the point where we started to say, well, maybe we should get in touch with Michael White and see. And that's when I sent you an email and yeah, said, do you think you might be interested? So that's when we decided, okay, we'll send it to Nature and we'll see what you think.
Ultimately, I think it went through three rounds of review. Was it three or was it actually four? I can't recall this point.
I think it was three lots of substantive reviews.
And what happened was that we lost one of the initial reviewers. And when that happens and we think that reviewer has some critical expertise, we have to bring in a replacement reviewer. And in this case, this replacement reviewer raised substantive issues, primarily on the statistical interpretation. When that happens from the author point of view, how do you and your colleagues feel when that happens? Do you view it as just the normal course of how things are going to go in review, or does it seem to you that there's any element of unfairness in that particular step?
I certainly didn't feel there was any unfairness in that. I think that the reviewer had valid points, and the points that they were raising were issues that we'd discussed mm-hmm. within the team as we'd been producing the paper. But we'd at that point, we'd come to the conclusion that this is really tough and we really don't know how to deal with, how do we quantify the uncertainty on reconstructions where we're only given the reconstruction and a standard deviation range? How do we put this into a change point method and get something that actually makes physical sense? We'd struggled with this, and in the end we'd kind of decided that we didn't think that we could do it. Mm-hmm. So actually having that extra push from the reviewer to really, okay, go back and look at this again, and you really need to do better.
Yeah.
When the reviews first come in, particularly sort of at that point, I think maybe after the second round of reviews, we kind of thought that we were pretty much there. And then having stuff come back and just go, oh. So there were certainly some deep breaths were required just to take all of that in. But I think it's the same. I think that's the same with any review process. You kind of, you see that email appear and you sort of go, you're a bit terrified to open it, and then you sort of give it a glance, and then really, I think I have this for every paper I publish, then I have to sort of just let it sit for a couple of days.
Yeah, that's critical, isn't it?
Absolutely. The review process was long for this one, I think it wasn't entirely, there were other things that were going on my end as well in terms of grant writing that meant that, mm-hmm. The turnaround on revisions wasn't always fast. So that wasn't just a review process issue.
Right.
I don't have any issues with the fact that we had the extra reviews and we had to jump through those extra hoops, because I think it was worthwhile and the points that were raised were valid. And in the end, we've come out with a much better product because of it.
I went to a meeting on statistical climatology a little while ago, thinking that I would come out of it with a better understanding of how this kind of statistics should be done. And instead, I came out even more confused than I was going in, with the overall impression that the uncertainty and how to approach this kind of statistical analysis is uncertain within the statistical community. And in some ways, it's philosophical. There are just different philosophies about how to do this kind of work. When you get back statistical reviews on your work, do you debate with you and your colleagues whether or not to just accept what the reviewer is doing sometimes, even if it's contrary to your philosophy about how statistics should be done, but just to satisfy the reviewer? Or would there be cases, not on this paper, but would there be cases in which you would just argue your approach and your philosophy and decline to do the review, the revision, excuse me?
I think we did do this in the paper that we published with Nature, in that there were some revisions that were asked for that we didn't necessarily agree that was the right way to go. And so we did the revisions, but we also in the response letter said, but for these reasons, actually, we don't think that's the right way to go. And here's what the figure would look like if we did it this other way. So I think that we're all, there's no sort of textbook on how you do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's research, and we're trying to figure out how we handle these records and the best ways of doing it. And there are different statistical ideas that you can use. I think one of the most powerful things that we can do with all of these types of reconstructions, reconstruction method, and also the statistical approaches that we're applying to the reconstructions, is to really sort of test them across a whole range of methods.
Right.
Because we don't know if there's an optimum or best way to go, and it probably depends on what base records you're using and the questions that you're asking. And so I think that if we can use multiple methods and still come up with a robust answer, then that's where I feel like we can start to have confidence that we can be talking about the small statistical details or completely different statistical methods, but if we get the same answer at the end of the day, then we can feel confident in that answer.
Agreed. You mentioned that some of the revisions on this paper were delayed from grant writing activities, and I see that you have an unusually large and long grant with a lot of collaborators called ARC, Center of Excellence for Climate Extremes. What's that project? Where did it come from? And what are you hoping to do over the next 6 years?
So that was a 700-page proposal. I wasn't leading it. 701 pages.
Well, you're not kidding about having to be kind of verbose in these applications.
Yeah. but it's an enormous project, and it's an enormous amount of money as well. So basically, so in Australia, we have these things called Centre of Excellence centres. Basically, they are where researchers from different universities come together. They partner with industry or other organisations. So, for example, the Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes. We've got the University of New South Wales, the Australian National University, Melbourne University, Monash University, the University of Tasmania, and we're partnered with the Bureau of Meteorology and CSIRO. And then along with that, we also have a whole raft of international partners. So I think there's 50 PIs from organisations around the world who are also affiliated with this Centre of Excellence. And all of those have a CV in this proposal. The Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes is building upon a centre that's been running in Australia since 2011. So that's the Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science. So it has those same partners, and it's largely people who are working on climate models and really trying to understand the processes going on in the climate system. So for the Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes, it's kind of the next step in that. So that'll start in July of 2017. What we're doing there is to try and move away from just looking at sort of the average climate. So we think that with climate models, with some exceptions, we're doing a reasonable job of being able to understand what the average climate is doing.
Right.
But the average climate really, for sort of day-to-day, that's really not what matters. What matters is those high impact events. So what's going to happen with floods? What's going to happen with heat waves? So those events that really cost a lot of money and cost a lot of life as well. So that's what we're trying to move towards, understanding those processes that lead to those very extreme climate events and being able to capture those in our climate modelling systems. Because we capture the average very well doesn't mean that we're doing a good job on those extreme events. So that's what the Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes will be tackling, and it feeds into international projects. So there's the WCRP has a Grand Challenge on Climate Extremes, so it's very closely aligned with that. PAGES will have an initiative on climate extremes. And I guess that my role in the centre is to bring the last millennium perspective into it. So to provide that link between what's going on in the PAGES 2K world and make the connection so that community can interact with this largely climate model based community, so really start to tackle the high impact problems.
Does that mean that you're going to be querying the PAGES 2K databases to extract information on the time variance of extremes?
Yes, particularly sort of we'll be using that sort of for trying to understand things like droughts and for trying to and making sure that we're getting the background variability right in those climate models. So the Centre of Excellence will focus on heat waves and cold snaps or cold outbreaks. It'll focus on extreme rain. It'll focus on droughts. And then it also has an aspect in there on climate variability, because we still need to understand those sort of decadal timescale changes that are going on, and making sure that we're getting those as well if we want to make sure we're getting the extremes. So it's bringing in that information where if you're talking about decadal variability, then really you have to step back and be using paleoclimate data. You can't get all of the answers just from the instrumental record.
Narelly Abram is working on some massive projects to try and make the bridge between paleoclimate variability and modern climate change. Narelly, thank you so much for the chat.
Thanks, Michael.
That was my interview with Narelly Abram from Australian National University. Narelly, thanks a lot. That was great. I already have in the can an interview with Gabe Vecchi, recorded completely unplanned on Inauguration Day. But Gabe was kind of out of it on that front in terms of the news. He's remodeling his house and has just moved to Princeton from GFDL. So we had a fantastic talk. I'm hoping to get that up in a couple of weeks. And still trying to schedule Jennifer McKinnon to have a hardcore discussion of ocean turbulence. If you'd like the show, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher, Google Play Music. I'm on Twitter, at MWClimateSci. You can reach me via email, forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes including, in this case, a lot of great photographs of Nerli doing her field work are at forecastpod.org. And so we're going to kind of wrap up with a special little addendum with Nerli telling me the geographical location from which she submitted her most recent Nature paper.
I don't know if I've ever told you that that Nature paper was submitted from Ayers Rock.
No.
There you go. So I had the paper on the Southern Annular Mode I submitted from Casey Station. So I worked on it, this paper on the Southern Ocean winds, I worked on it as we crossed the Southern Ocean on the Aurora Australis and submitted it when I got to Casey Station. Because again, it was, I'm going to submit this paper before I go on field work, and it didn't happen. And then this one was, I'm going to submit this before I go on holidays, traveling through the Northern Territory for a month, and it didn't happen. So we got to Ayers Rock and I found an internet cafe, and that's when I submitted that paper. Yeah, I always thought it'd be nice, as well as the submission date, to also have the submission location would be cool.